Accession number 8337, Reel 3.
General Graham, Reel 3. And of course, to see our own losses were extremely grievous, but all of us were shocked and appalled in the later stages of the Battle of Normandy at the destruction suffered by the German army and the thousand upon thousand of dead Germans, good young men who'd just been conscripted and made to fight for their country, and they fought with considerable distinction. And, of course, worse still, the hundreds of dead horses, because the German army was still 75% horse-drawn, which were only the elite units, which were fully mechanized. Carnage was fearful. And I think, just on a personal note, one of the reasons that I decided to remain a regular soldier, or remain a soldier, professionally after the war, which is something I never intended to be, was to, in a small way, do my best to see that by perhaps being a little more military strong and efficient than our country had been between, say, 1918 and 39, one might be able to play a part in deterring another war, or perhaps if one had to break out fighting with a little more expertise. And so it seems to have occurred.
You said that the next thing that you saw was that happened to you was the sight of this bombing of Caen. Mm. What happened next?
Well, of course, after that, there was that big attempt, Operation Goodwood, for three armored divisions to break out to the east of Caen, seize the Borgabus Ridge. Well, of course, we couldn't see this happening because we were the wrong side of Caen, but we heard about it, and you will well know that, again, that was a major failure. German defence rallied despite the heavy bombing from the air. The British armour got separated from its infantry, and very little progress was made at very considerable cost, particularly in tanks. And so that operation to break out and get to Paris failed.
Were you concerned in that personally?
No, not at all, because we were still over on the west side of Caen, but our turn came next. We were then shifted from the Caen sector over to the Caumont sector, where we relieved an American regiment. And you will remember that at about this period of the campaign, the Americans had cleared up Cherbourg, the Cotentin Peninsula, and were beginning Operation Cobra, the great sweep out from the Cherbourg Peninsula, which was to take them up to the Seine and eventually to the Saar and the Rhine. Well, to facilitate this great sweep by the Americans, we were moved to the Caumont sector, took over from an American unit, and did an operation called Bluecoat, along with some other British formations, such as the 43rd Division and the Guards Iron and Tank Brigade, southwards to draw off Germans, as we tried to do at Caen, and therefore make easier the passage eastwards of the American forces. And that was a hard struggle against groups of Germans. And not only Germans, I might say, there were Russians and Poles and Croats and all sorts in field grey fighting, and fighting very well. We used to have quite a struggle, you know, the rifle platoons and companies to get from one side of a field to the other or to clear a farm. And in the end, you'd find, what were there, 20-odd Germans or 20-odd enemy, a couple of German corporals, three Poles, two Russians, a Yugoslav or two, German private, a great mixed bag, but fighting very well under German direction until they obviously had to surrender and up with their hands. But they fought no less well for being foreign, not being German.
Did their behaviour after surrender seem to be any different from the Germans?
Oh, yes, very glad, of course. And indeed, I remember one day two young Yugoslavs came and surrendered to me personally, and I gave them a meal, we chatted away. I forget what language you use, German, I suppose. And then I said, well, we've got so many German prisoners. We simply don't know what to do with them. We can't feed them. I said this in jest. I said, I'm going to send you back. The Germans must feed you. But they really were frightened stiff. They took me seriously, because I was only pulling their legs. But no, they were very, very glad, as were many of the Germans, that the war for them was over.
Did they surrender easily or not?
You can't generalize. Some you had to kill.
How long did Operation Blue Coats last?
I'd say about a week.
And your own personal part in it was what?
I was still adjutant. Rather like the Gavis battle, we went a long way with a considerable success. We had some casualties, some mines and mortaring, and of course some machine guns. The worst blow actually was having got to the objective with the Churchill tanks of that excellent Guards Army Tank Brigade, with whom we'd had such a close relationship ever since 1943, training in England. Two Tiger tanks appeared over our left rear, and in the space of a few minutes wrote off 14 of these Churchill tanks and then just shrug it off. Again, a question of the German armour being superior to our own and killing our tanks at ranges ours couldn't touch them at.
Did you ever use captured German equipment?
I personally carried a Schmeisser submachine pistol from that first battle at Gavras onwards, because it was superior, in my view, to the Sten.
Could you get ammunition for it?
Took the same 9mm ammunition.
What happened after Operation Blue Coat?
There was a slogging battle further south. There are places called Estrie and Montpensant. And St. Martin, which our battalion and other battalions got embroiled with. Very stiff fighting against small groups of really fanatical Germans, mostly SS, who probably have a hell of a fight for these crossroads and these little copses and these little Norman villages, and causes a lot of delay and considerable amount of grief. As I think I told you, it was in this area that we suffered this major blow from the night bombing. But it was a slow grind forward. We lost some good men. But nevertheless, the strategy worked, and we drew these Germans onto us, and the Americans, you know, did their sweep round. And the final result, of course, was the closing, the belated closing of the Falaise pocket. In which we'd played no part, so the Polish Armoured Division and the Allied forces, and the Canadians particularly, in the car sector, were, I understand, a bit slow in moving south to meet the Americans coming up from the north. And this slowness in closing this gap enabled very large numbers of Germans, without their kit, to actually get across the Seine, which helped, of course, the Germans to re-establish a line of defence on the waterways in Belgium and Holland. But after the crushing defeat of the German army in the Falaise area, and the slaughter was immense and the loss of kit was dreadful, we really thought that the Germans would have to give in by the end of 44. And as you know, of course, we went into Belgium. We had some difficult battles in Belgium on the canals. But come early September, the Guards Armored Division liberated Brussels. And then we all pressed up into Holland, where everybody, the enthusiasm of the population to see us, remarkable. But the whole thing got bogged down. The whole impetus of the advance bogged down. And the reasons were really very simple. The kit, the supplies, the materiel for the Allied forces was still coming ashore in Normandy or Cherbourg. There were no other ports nearer where we were. Antwerp had not been cleared of enemy. Calais, Dunkirk, and these other French ports, Le Havre, were still held by German garrison troops with orders to delay their capture by the Allies and opening up a new support. And so all the material had to come a hell of a long way by road. And people got tired, and I've already explained how the Germans rallied with great skill, great expertise, and great devotion. And indeed, I think there are two things must be said about the German army in Normandy. The first is that they had not been bled white on the Eastern Front fighting the Russians. I do not know how we could have got a foothold in Europe and stayed there and eventually beaten them without the use of the atomic weapon. It would not have been possible. God knows it was hard enough up against the remnants of the Wehrmacht, the remainder having been engaged on the Eastern Front. And the other thing is, of course, the professional expertise of the German soldier. In very broad terms, I would say there are very few people of the rank of the visual commander and below in the German army who deserve to lose the war. But above that rank, very few who deserve to win it. The subordinates were let down immensely by the superiors. Bad generalship, of course, with the crowning reason, the madness of Hitler.
Were you conscious during the campaign in northwestern Europe of coordination with the Russians on the Eastern Front?
No, not at all. Not at all. One knew from the newspapers what was going on.
You mentioned the enthusiasm of the Dutch. How did that compare with how you were received in Belgium?
Oh, very similar, actually. But the Dutch, I think, had suffered more. As you know, the whole of Holland was not liberated at an early stage, and therefore, come the later stages of their campaign, they really were suffering very severely from starvation and German oppression. They had not, of course, been occupied in World War I. Therefore, occupation in World War II was an unpleasant and novel experience. They're very akin to us, and we got along very well, and they really were rapturous in their enthusiasm to greet us. But so were the Belgians, too. The Belgians were very, very kind and hospitable. But we were in Belgium for less time.
What happened to you next after the hold-up in the autumn?
Well, the Operation Market Garden was launched by the Airborne Corps, culminating, of course, in the drop at Arnhem, about which, curiously, we knew very little. It was on, but it didn't really impinge, even on me. I was still adjutant. And we had the task of clearing a bit of the corridor leading up towards Arnhem, generally in the Eindhoven sector, against pretty low-grade German opposition. But there was no sense of urgency. This is a curious thing. The attention of our commanders at the higher level seemed to be entirely on the 30 Corps thrust and Arnhem, and there was nobody got the whip out onto us and said, you've got to get cracking, because we performed in these wretched farming estates of Holland, with their woods and their deep ditches, rather miserably. It was not a happy experience, just grinding forward, the steady drain of losses, you know, each day, if nothing in particular. Great events were happening not very far away, but we were unconscious of them. And we just had a rather dreary job to do in Holland. And then, of course, as the autumn went into winter, we liberated Tilburg, a very big and very prosperous town, Tilburg, and were very well received indeed. We had no difficulty there. But we hadn't been there more than 24 hours before the Germans, I think it was 47th Panzer Corps, put in an attack westwards in South Holland against the Americans and caused the Americans a lot of anxiety. The result was that we were all hauled out of bed, put into lorries in Tilburg, and had to go down to the south of Holland, what they call the Pale Country, P-E-L, which means marshland and bog. And I think we got there at the end of October, and we stayed there, gradually closing up to the River Maas until Christmas time. And it really was the most unpleasant experience, because everywhere there were mines. There were shoe mines, the German shoe mine, you know, which took off the fort, and there were the bar mine, or which is a bigger contraption for use against vehicles. All the buildings had been destroyed by the retreating Germans, a lot of booby traps, and it never stopped raining. And, of course, the communications were really just farm tracks designed for horses and carts. But, of course, after perhaps a week's rain and tanks and crocodiles and Bren carriers and lorries, the place was an absolute morass. And it was the most lousy, awful experience. And we refer to it always as the abomination of desolation, the pale country south of Helmond in Holland. And it was a struggle against nature as much as against the Germans. But gradually, we closed up to the line of the Maas against German resistance from SB guns and little groups of infantry and so on, and of course, incessant mines and booby traps. But it was pretty bloody. And we had, I suppose, during that period of 2-odd, 3 months, the same experiences the infantry had in World War I in the trenches for many years.
Were you actually in trenches a great deal?
Oh, in slits, yes. Oh, yes, always had to have slits. Perhaps as adjutant I was more lucky, because I tended to try and get into a barn or what was left of a cottage, for obvious reasons, I mean, for the command post. But I ceased being adjutant about this time and was given command of a company. Actually, it was a reduced-strength company, because we lost a lot of men without reinforcements, and therefore had to have, instead of 4 rifle companies, we had 3 full-strength rifle companies and this battle group. And my battle group was 50-odd men, but with the firepower of a company. And we did some quite interesting things, sort of always, of course, in the advance to contact, we were the up in the front, the van, for obvious reasons. And then, of course, because of our firepower, we could hold bits of ground quite satisfactorily and use our firepower to good effect. And it was quite a good experience for me, that. And then eventually reinforcements came and we got back our 4th companies, and I became a proper company commander, or a commander of a proper rifle company.
You made the comparison with the First World War, but did you have such complaints as trench foot and so on that they had then?
Some people got trench feet, yes. I don't know if it was called trench foot. Put it this way, after about a week in sodden socks and boots, soldiers had to go to the doctor to get their feet put right, and they were away for a few days, but only a few days. But of course the medical support we had, and above all things like the tins of self-eating soup, tins of soup, you just tuck the wick with the cigarette end, and a wick burnt round the soup, and then when it opened up, you got a tin of hot soup, which had cooked itself in your hand. These things, you know, which they didn't have in World War I, made life pretty tolerable. And the logistics of the whole campaign from D-Day onwards were first class. The mail, the food, all the things that soldiers needed. Winter clothing, even snow clothing. It snowed a lot. We got white suits. Somebody thought of it, and they came up.
How would the bad feet be treated? Would any...
Oh, I think larger question of cleaning them up and drying them out, giving the chap a rest. Most complaints on the battlefield, in my limited experience, were best cured by a good night's rest. Everybody has a breaking point, and some people break earlier than others, but everybody breaks sooner or later. And the job of a commander is to watch when an individual or group of individuals is approaching this point, saying, right, back you go, 5 miles back, a really good kip in a village or in a barn or something, good square meal, then, you know, their batteries are recharged and they go back to the line and start again. And this was appreciated, and divisions at a very early stage set up their divisional clubs or welfare centres, perhaps on the French coast, to which people, you know, when they were tired, could go off and just recuperate. And so did the Americans later on. They had the same system.
What signs would you look out for?
Signs? They varied. Some people shook. Some people simply didn't register what you were trying to say to them. Others were extremely slow to react to an order. I think, too, when people under strain, their language gets worse. Blasphemy and foul language. That's always a sign when it's on the increase. Irritability with a capital I.
And if they didn't have the rest, what would happen?
A very small number. Use the sugar off. All ranks. You know? We're there 1 hour and we're not there the next. Occasionally got picked up in the rear area. Others, not that I can remember this in my own unit, but some people did inflict injuries on themselves in order to get to the hands of the doctor and get a blighty one. But by and large, in our unit, the troops behaved very well indeed. I think it was more satisfactory in our division in general than it was in certain of the other ones. I've read some rather alarming stories recently about the breakdown of morale in certain other Allied formations and units. We were very lucky. The Scots were a very good soldier, and we were well led and well trained.
What happened next after this experience in the Pale Country?
We closed up the Maas. We spent Christmas and New Year on the Maas. And then the invasion of Germany proper began. Operation Veritable. The break out from the Nijmegen area through the Siegfried line, as far as we were concerned, in 15 Scottish, from the general area of Kranenburg, the town of Kranenburg, just north of the Reichswald Forest. The 53rd Welsh Division were now right in the Reichswald Forest, and that was already just like World War One. And here I must just make a point about manpower. One of the things which made me a young officer aware at a very early stage of the relative impotence of the United Kingdom as a military power was this question of manpower. After our first battle round Gavras, we, of course, received reinforcements. And the first reinforcements we received were what's called the left out of battles. That is that cadre of about 90 people of all ranks who were specifically not engaged in that battle but left in security so that if there'd been a disaster, there was at least a nucleus around which the battalion could be reformed. Well, they came. And then, of course, we got people from the Durham Light Infantry, the Hampshires, all sorts of regiments. Nothing to do at all with Scotland. And, of course, although we didn't send many divisions to Normandy, within 2 months of getting there, two divisions had to be broken up to keep the remainder going, because the infantry casualties, above all, were much heavier than had been anticipated. And the 59th Staffordshire Division, the Potteries Division, and I think it was the 50th Tyne and Tees Division, were broken up. And we received reinforcements from them. And, of course, later on, and I'm talking now about in Holland, Belgium and Holland, the reinforcements we got were either our own wounded returned to us from hospital, or not trained infantrymen, but people from anti-aircraft command, who by that time had conquered the German Air Force and the flying bomb, you remember, and anti-aircraft command, therefore, the Royal Artillery in the UK could be reduced inside. These people were given a quick conversion course to infantry, rebadged and sent out to us. Now, by this time, of course, the number of people in the battalion of all ranks who had actually landed in Normandy and were still serving was quite small, very small. So a combination of lack of trained leaders and lack of trained manpower coming to be led by us meant that the most simple tactics had to be employed. And that is why I think I said to you that from this time on, you know, Operation Veritable onwards was really rather like the infantry assault of World War One, I suspect. White tape was put down, people formed up, and went forward at a certain regulated pace behind a barrage of, in the case of Veritable, I think 1,200 guns. which the barrage then halted for 3 minutes, then coloured smoke, and then they lifted, and on you went. But really, very undemanding. But anything more ambitious, I think, would have been beyond us, simply because the trained leaders and the trained soldiers were no longer there. And that was the sort of instrument with which we had to complete the campaign from New Year's Eve, from New Year 44, 45 onwards.
Did the Battle of the Bulge, the German offensive in the Ardennes, have any impact on you? What did you think of it? Did it arouse great...
Well, it did, actually, because there's no doubt that the Germans under von Rundstedt, in launching this attack in the Ardennes area against the Americans, not only caught the Americans complete with their trousers down, but actually did something which we all believed was beyond them. And as you know, what they intended to do was to cross the Maas and get up and actually get in the rear of the Allied forces and perhaps strike as far as the port of Antwerp. Very ambitious plan. But there was a certain amount of trepidation. And, of course, at the same time, the German Air Force produced its major effort. And I think it was on New Year's Day, something like 400 sorties were delivered against our bit of the army, Second Army. And I think a lot of Royal Air Force planes on fields near Brussels were destroyed by this... the last day of glory of the German Air Force and the whole of the campaign. No, there was a certain amount of trepidation, and indeed the 3rd British Division, one of our neighbours, had to go down to help restore the situation in the Ardennes, and it meant too, of course, that attention was fastened on that sector, and we were kept in a pretty static role. And of course it was the weather that saved them, because the Germans attacked under mist and cloud and snow, and of course the Allied air forces could do very little against them, and the Germans made a lot of headway. Then of course the weather cleared and the skies came blue and the sun shone and the air force had a heyday, and the German attack just petered out.
Did it ever seem at any stage that the Germans might drive the Allies out of Northwest Europe?
No, I must say this from the very beginning, that even before we left the UK to go to Normandy, I certainly felt that I belonged to a team under Montgomery and Churchill and Eisenhower, which had been extremely well trained, that there was no question at all of defeat. We might have reverses in a certain operation. The thing might not go according to plan. We were warned about all that. But there's no question of not winning the campaign and not winning the war. And it wasn't just a question either of faith in our leaders. I think one must say that we are still a Christian nation, and it was undoubtedly the forefront in the minds of many people that it was a campaign which had to be won, because right was fighting wrong, and right tends to come out on top. And of course, as I told you earlier, we had heard about the massacres, the Holocaust, the concentration camps, Babi Yar, and these things. And of course, the longer one stayed in Europe, the more one became aware of the results of the German occupation, slave labor, and all these things. And of course, indeed, in Germany itself, places like Belsen became common knowledge.
What did you personally see of all this? If anything?
Very little. Very little indeed. I was wounded crossing the Rhine, so I fell out then in March and went back to, at the end of the war, I went back in July, I think. And then after a short spell, the battalion ran down and they were either demobilized or people like me staying in the army were sent to Palestine.
How were you wounded? Can you describe it?
Yes, I think it was a Canadian shell that burst somewhere and I got hit on the head.
So that effectively was the end of the Second World War as far as you were concerned.
Right. And then we, as I say...